is when you're assuming that someone is being honest with you, you're so much more in tune when there's a variance to tell you otherwise. Whereas if you start suspicious, everything is a clue. Everything is a problem. And so if you start honest, like, well, why wouldn't they tell me the truth? Then when somebody pings something different, your radar is so much more alert than if you're disqualifying things you assume are dishonest.
You're listening to The Lowdown, a podcast recorded at Sigma Kappa National Headquarters by Alex Green and Sarah Goodwin. We'll focus on topics like health, wellness, fraternity and sorority community, higher education, and life skills that women need in all stages of their lives. We'll also feature stories from inspiring, empowering, and ambitious Sigma Kappas. Tune in every other week for a new episode to help drive your personal growth forward.
Welcome back to the Lowdown Podcast. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Alex.
And today we have a previous guest back on the podcast, Lisa Mitchell. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thanks for letting me come hang out again.
So, for those who don't know, Lisa is the premier Indianapolis-based communications expert specializing in body language and nonverbal skills training. And the last episode that we had Lisa on was about how not to be awkward in interviews. So, we will have that linked in the show notes if you want to go back and listen to that and find out a little bit more about Lisa's background. But we're going to go ahead and jump right into this episode, which is all about using our body language to increase confidence within ourselves. So I think we're all pretty excited about this topic because I think we can all use a confidence boost no matter how confident we are or aren't.
Yeah, I agree. Like, nothing looks better on somebody than confidence, right? You can be the most pulled together, professionally dressed person in the room and still be a hot mess, and people will vibe on that so fast. Yeah, you got to really like own the whole thing from the inside out.
But I think Sarah actually said she had a story about personal confidence that she wanted to share with our lowdowners.
Sure. So something that we talked about in the last episode with Lisa is what she calls head trash, which a lot of us call imposter syndrome. So things that we think in our head that aren't necessarily true, and that's something that I have had struggled with. I mean, I still do struggle with it a little bit, about thinking that I'm not the best at what I do, and obviously I'm still learning in my job and everything, but when I was applying for this job at Sigma Kappa to be the social and digital media specialist, I didn't think that I would get to the next round. I kind of applied on a whim, thinking like, it'll be fun. Like, I'm not going to get this interview or the next one. And so I didn't tell a lot of people that I was applying because I'm like, they wouldn't think that I'm going to get this. Like, it doesn't make sense. I mean, it's what I want to do, but I'm not as qualified as I should be. And then I made it to the next round and they invited me to fly in. And so then I finally told people that I was going to Indianapolis to apply for this job. But I've kind of always thought that in any job I've applied to that I'm not qualified, and so I try to keep it quiet because I'm worried about what people will say about it, even though whenever I do, everyone's like, oh my gosh, that's right up your alley, like, I'm so excited for you. And so I've gotten better about being more open when opportunities come my way and saying, like, there's something out there, like, all of that, but it's something that I've begun to overcome a little bit because I've had a lot of support around me.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you'll share that because it's like it's such a thing that happens to everybody. And it doesn't matter how successful you are or how credentialed you are or what type of education you have or how many times you've done it before. Mm-hmm. Like, head trash is so, so real. And I think when you couple head trash and with fear of judgment of like, what will people think? Or, you know, I don't want to be embarrassed, or what if nobody, you know, cheers me on? Like, all of that is just like a big pile of suck that if you don't challenge yourself, it can sink you. Like, there's so much research around, you know, specifically you mentioned going for a job opportunity. And women, unless they are like 95% like to the affirmative of checking every single box of a job requirement, consider themselves unqualified and will not apply. Guys are like 35%, right? And they throw it against the wall and hope for the best and don't apologize for it. Yeah. And so I think now that there's more research around that and there's more conversation around it, I think women are starting to become a little more bold around just squashing the head trash and going for stuff. If nothing else, just to kind of spite the guys that seem to do it without any second thought at all. Right. So I think from a timing perspective, like the conversation is shifting a little bit, which is nice. But yeah, it's one of those things where head trash can really, it can immobilize you. Mm-hmm. Like you can be your own worst enemy and no one's taking opportunity away from you, but you're denying it to yourself, which is like the worst.
Right.
Yeah.
But so body language on it. Really comes into play in this with your confidence, whether it's, we'll talk about some first impressions, offense and defense type of stuff. But let's just talk like, so if you're just trying to build your confidence, you're just, maybe you recently graduated and like Sarah, like you don't think you can get the job and we don't have to go into the interview stuff because please go listen to the other episode. But, but just in general, how you can feel more confident just in being who you are and being who you're meant to be.
Yeah, I think one of the things, unfortunately, that women in particular tend to do, especially kind of early stage or people who don't have a, you know, a long and storied resume to fall back on, is we play really, really small. And that can be physically showing up in a room small, not taking up a lot of space. Like, it cracks me up. And when I'm in a room, a mixed room of male and female professionals, we will talk about this. And I'll just do, before I tell them what I'm doing, I just say freeze frame. And, like, look around. Who's claiming the most space? Mm-hmm. And it's almost always, without fail, a male. And the women, you know, we like to come and sit down in our meetings, and we like to, like, keep our notebooks and our coffee mug and everything aligned no wider than our shoulders because mm-hmm. we don't want to take up too much space.
Yeah.
And then we're seen as playing small. Whereas you look beside you and somebody's got, like, 3 seats worth of table space and an arm thrown over an extra chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is perceived, whether it's your intention or not. Mm-hmm. The perception is that someone else is more credible or more powerful because they're claiming more space.
Yeah.
That is just how people's brains decode other people. Mm-hmm. So you're automatically putting yourself at a disadvantage if you walk into a space and you play small, whether you're at a dinner or whether yeah. you're in a meeting, you know, or sitting across from someone for conversation. It's fun to Starbucks creep and just walk in, and I maybe not everyone thinks it's fun to Starbucks creep.
Oh, I think everyone does.
I can't not do it. And to just, or anywhere where meetings are happening and interviews are happening, and just see the dynamics of who's feeling confident, who's leading the meeting, mm-hmm. who's maybe superior in position versus somebody else. You can read it just by the amount of space that people are taking up.
Yeah.
And the trick is to build confidence, to take up more, whether you feel like you deserve it or not. So that doesn't mean like bust through the door like the Kool-Aid man, right? Like you don't want to be fake. You don't want to, yeah. you don't want to have it, because fake confidence is like the worst mm-hmm. type of confidence. But you can affirm yourself, taking up more space. Even, you know, how you walk into a room with your head up and your shoulders back without, you know, the quickest way to shrink is to have your face in your phone.
Yeah.
And so how many times do you walk into a room where you're sending a text, or you walk into a meeting and your face is in your phone, or you're distracting yourself? Mm-hmm. And you're like all hovered over, shoulders hunched in, head down,
yeah.
you know, lost in your phone. That actually signals to your body intrinsically, like physiologically, to get small and to be protective. And it spikes your cortisol, mm-hmm. your stress hormone. Anytime we get small or shrink in on ourselves, our body's like, oh, we need to protect. And it starts firing the survival mechanism. So you're mm-hmm. actually stressing yourself out, like wow. legit stressing yourself out by putting your body in a smaller, tighter position.
Yeah. I mean, I can't walk into a room with my hands on my hips, my shoulders back, like taking big wide steps. So
right. I'll be like on the runway.
Yeah, that is so true.
If you do, will you video it and send it
Sarah
to
Sarah will. Please. We'll see the reaction awesome. Of the room of when that happens.
I cannot wait.
Next staff meeting.
Yes. Yeah, that'll be awesome.
So how do you take up more space without, you know, having your hands on your hips or, you know, your starfish?
Yeah,
stance, which is hands up,
head up, it's shoulders back, it's chest open, like not, it's decoded as a protective measure if you walk in with something covering kind of your torso or your midsection. So if you're someone who stands with your drink in front of you or your purse in front of you or your computer bag in front of you, like yeah. that's being perceived as, oh, you feel like you need to be protective.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we do. Like if I'm in an environment and I'm super awkward at networking events and I hate it, and I will find myself just standing with something covering my midsection, yeah. which I know is having me perceived as like less confident.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel super dorky when I stand with my hands to my side or like hold my drink to the side yeah. versus the front. But that is I care enough about the perception that someone has of me that I'll feel dorky for a minute until I like adjust to the new normal.
Hmm. What are some other good first impression body language? I don't even know. Just body languages that you can use. I don't know what word to use there.
Yeah. Body language behaviors.
Thank you. Yes. Body language behaviors.
Words are good. So it's really like first you kind of need to understand how people form first impressions of you. And there's kind of two levels of first impressions. There's that first, when I see you in my space, are you going to kill me or hurt me? So there's that limbic brain, lizard brain first impression of, are you a threat? Mm-hmm. And that's the one you need to satisfy first. And so that's really showing that you're open, keeping your hands visible. It's basically like caveman brain saying, do you have a weapon behind your back?
Yeah.
And if I can't tell for sure that you're not a threat, I have to, at a biological level, assume that you might be. So I can't turn the alarm all the way off until I know that you don't have something to harm me.
Hmm.
So disarming people's alarm right away is a great way. So visible hands, signaling good intentions, so smiling, nodding, acknowledging, all of that is great. So people know that, hey, you're aware that I'm in your space.
Yeah.
Plus it's kind of flattering to be acknowledged, you know. And so any type of cue, genuine smile is great. Fake smile is a kiss of death. And so there's a difference. And you can tell, like, if you guys listening, just put it on your face right now. Like, think of something that brings you so much joy and just throw that smile on your face, right? Where do you feel it?
Like in my eyes or my upper cheeks.
Yeah, like there's this whole lift activation thing. Like that's where all my beautiful crow's feet comes from because I'm a very joyful person.
You're so happy.
I am. Totally true. Lots of joy in my life. And then put a fake smile on your face.
It's more in my like...
What feels different?
Seems more in my like lips or like my like...
Just
not a full facial.
It's just mouth activation, right? Like if you were to block your face from the nose down, you would not even know from the top part of your face that anything was happening. Yeah. And people are very...
Smizing is real.
Smizing, yes, for real. Tyra had it absolutely right. And if you dishonor someone with a fake smile, like that's how they take it, is insulting or suspicious.
Yeah.
Like what, you can't like really go to the trouble to crinkle your eyes for me? Like why are you not... So fake happy is not sort of happy. Fake happy is like alarmingly not happy. Like fake happy is almost sinister.
Oh yeah.
I'm not.
It's like you're dead inside, but you're just trying to show.
Right. Yeah. Like why? Mm-hmm. Think about the cognitive process it takes to do that. Right. This is why I'm so suspicious and off put by fake smiles. Is because you know. So when I see a fake smile come at me, I know that you should smile.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you don't want to smile. I know that you've thought about the consequence for not smiling. And I know that you've put the effort to give me a fake smile. Like, that's a four-step cognitive load strategy for you to not really smile at me.
Yeah.
What is wrong with you? Right? Like, that's where my brain goes. I automatically feel like, why?
Yeah.
So you're trying to, your intention may be to have me perceive you as happy, but I'm perceiving you as diabolical instead. So it's not always about what your intention is. It's how are people perceiving you and what can you do to help land that in the favorable zone. So fake smiles, kiss to death. Don't do it either. Smile for real or don't smile. Pick a different expression.
Yeah.
Fake smiles are really insulting.
Yeah. My husband he just doesn't like to get his picture taken. And so he has just like, it's a fake smile in the picture. I'm like, Ben, you look dead.
Smile.
You look dead inside. Can we like...
He's like, help me. I'm stuck. This is the worst thing ever.
Yes. And so he has to be like in the middle of doing something and just happen to look at the camera while he's smiling. And it's like the best picture. But that's kind of what I picture when he said these dead smiles is...
Poor Ben.
I know. Yeah. I really...
And isn't it a shame because you know, like there's a couple people that come to mind that have like the most beautiful smile and I've never seen it in a photograph. Because choose like this photo smile, which is like not a real smile. And then I'm like, what a shame. What a wasted opportunity.
Yeah. I love talking about the negatives. I just think they're so funny. Do we have any other negative body language behaviors?
Yeah. Positioning is a big one. So space and position. So space is this idea of how much like earth are you having between you and the person across from you. And there's actually like zones of spatial kind of awareness, I guess, that you have. And most people make the mistake of either trying to have meaningful conversation where it's more social space, so like 7 feet and beyond, right? So instead of closing the gap and honoring and engaging, mm-hmm. because of awkwardness or laziness or whatever, we don't get into that zone of optimal kind of like personal space.
That's within 7 feet, you said?
Outside of 7 feet.
Oh, outside, yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, and so 5 to 7 feet is social space. So that's like you could communicate. There's a lot of room for interference mm-hmm. and distraction. Yeah. So probably nothing really meaningful or serious would happen there. And then there's like 1.5 to 5 feet. So that's kind of like personal space. Yeah. So that's where you can have meaningful conversation. You can engage at an appropriate level. It's not overly intrusive, but you're probably not going to have somebody come walk in front of you. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Again, awareness is a beautiful thing. Not everybody has it. And then there's intimate space, which is like 0 to 18 yeah. inches, right? So you also don't necessarily want to engage in casual, meaningful chat at 18 mm-hmm. inches away from someone. Cultural differences apply, of course. In some cultures, like if you're not toe-to-toe and face-to-face, you're not engaged, and yeah. it's insulting and it's bad for business. Mm-hmm. So you always want to have that kind of cultural awareness too. Mm-hmm. And it's really, my rule of thumb is to extend grace to who's on the other side of you and adapt to their comfort level. Yeah. And I think that's particularly important when you're talking about populations with neurodiversity or perhaps on the autism spectrum or social anxiety where they have a different comfort level.
Yeah.
Everything from eye contact to personal space is kind of adjusted. Mm-hmm. And it's always great when you can acknowledge that and give them the opportunity to communicate in the space that's comfortable for them. Yeah.
I feel like that's also like men versus women when they, like, I've heard that men like to stand side by side when they, it's like a man and a man talking, where women, I guess, more square up. So right. it's like when a man and a woman are talking, I don't know what will happen.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I've talked to men. I just don't remember right now what that looked like.
It relies on context. And context, a big part of the context filter is what is our relationship and what is normal for us. So if it's someone, you know, I've had male counterparts that I've worked with for decades. Every time I see them, we get a hug. You mm-hmm. know, we're fine yeah. being mm-hmm. in close personal space. We usually will talk face to face, and that's not weird or awkward or intrusive.
Yeah.
But we've earned the right based on context and relationship to engage yeah. that way. So it's just knowing when you've earned the right,
yeah.
You know, to close up conversation or get closer, and when you haven't, and to respect that space. It's emotional intelligence, really, yeah. at its finest. But awareness, again, yes. is a beautiful yeah. thing. We've all had the close talker and the person who, like, I had a guy talk to me after an event one time, and he literally, like, painted me into a corner. I had, like, less than 18 inches of personal space in a corner, and I legit, like, turned my whole body and, like, slid out
from the other side.
Yeah, I was getting sweaty and hot, and he wasn't threatening at all. No. Yeah. He was just, like, super excited to talk about what we had talked about. But, yeah, sometimes you got to just, mm-hmm. like, it's not always about being polite. It's about feeling safe and feeling mm-hmm. comfortable. And that is, you know, there's a balance. There's a way that you can kind of de-escalate a situation or get yourself safe, which should always be your number one yeah. priority. Like, screw feelings. Like, be polite when you can, and yeah. when you don't feel safe, then, you know, do what you need to do to yeah. stay safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we talked about some of the things to avoid
right.
when you are making a first impression. What are some body language behaviors that you should do when you are trying to make
or facial expressions
yeah.
too?
Yeah. Facial expressions are really key, and there's kind of two different sets of facial expressions. There are the micro expressions. Those are the 1/10 to 1/25 of a second flashes of true intense emotion that we show up on our face. It's like when somebody whacks your knee at the doctor and your leg flies out, like the same mm-hmm. thing happens on our face, like almost a reflex. And then our brain kicks in and is like, what's the consequence for expressing this? And most of the time, because we fear judgment as adults, we're like, oh, we can't keep anger on our face because then I'm going to have a difficult conversation. So I'm going to mm-hmm. erase that and show you happy. So again, all the cognitive process that's happening in our brain of like expression, truth, consequence, choice.
So you're supposed to read those on people or just like be aware of what's happening?
Yeah. If you can see the flash, and it is really quick, but there's all sorts of great training tools and like flashcards and things you can do to help your brain automate it, because that's what happens is once you've studied it, and the way I train it is it's, what does it look like, and by that it's like, what does it feel like? Mm-hmm. So you can mirror it on your own face if you're confused. So what does it look and feel like? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. And then what should you do to respond? Because that's the thing. Because there's lots of times where you see anger or contempt flash. And again, you may not know what to call it, but you know the first vibe is not good.
Yeah.
And then they change it. And you have the choice to, do I just accept what they've chosen to show me? Or do we circle back on that initial and dig a little deeper and see what the problem is? And when it comes to like managers or leaders or people that are trying to really connect with people, that difference between choosing not to respond or choosing to respond can make all the difference in the world and how effective you are. Because it means I really see you and I'm paying attention to you, which you have to do if you're going to catch these. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I'm going to take the time and emotional energy to respond to you. So that's something you can do to make a great first impression, is clue into, what am I really seeing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then being the proactive one to circle back on that. It's like, oh, well, it looks like that's great, but did you have, and the best thing you can do is like ask, is that what you expected?
Like when you answer something and
then right. So if you see a flash and they tell you something else, great, glad we're on the same page. Is that what you expected? And they'll be like, well, actually, I had a question about this or this, or maybe I didn't understand that. Yeah. Because is that what you expected is not a confrontational question at all.
No.
So you can say, is that what you expected, or does that match with what you were thinking? Well, actually, sort of, but what about this or that? Yeah. And then it like opens up this whole dialogue of effective communication, and you look like a genius because you clued back to meet their need that they were afraid to express.
That's super helpful, because sometimes, I mean, I haven't really done that, but I'll see that flash and then be like, I don't ask them if that's what they've expected. And so then it makes me a little anxious, like,
right. Because you just feel like you kind of vibe off, like something wasn't, but then you can't identify it. And so then you spin all these horror stories in your head about how dumb you are and something's going to go wrong. Yeah, that's what I do at least. I don't want to speak for you, but
it's pretty accurate.
That's how it works for me.
Yeah. You said there were two facial expressions, right? That
the micro expression and then it's the chosen expression. So that's the one the person picks and sustains. Right. So like I'll fake smile at you all day long if it avoids me, even if I'm really angry at first.
Yeah.
If I just want to get away, I'm just going to fake smile and hope you don't pick up on it and then be like, she's stupid.
I would feel kind of dumb if someone pointed that out, which I'm sure I'm really bad at it, because I know I have probably worse reactions than I put on my face. Actually, I will rephrase. I know that how I react to certain situations, and I can think back in the past of like, didn't like this idea, but I knew that I needed to be supportive. And so they probably saw it, probably knew. I mean, I've maybe gotten some feedback that I'm not always the best. My facial expressions are not always the greatest. So that's interesting that's.
Yeah. I had a client, like usually I'm coaching people to be more expressive and kind of build confidence through managing the offense or how they're showing up in a room. I actually had a client that had gotten feedback that her facial expressions and nonverbals were so strong in meetings that she was like poisoning her team's reception of new ideas because they were reading her resistance to it. And so we actually had to work on how to mute those responses because her natural responses, because the thing about us humans is that, like, think about when you're angry. What are the odds that it's just going to be a flash of anger microexpression and no other signals?
Oh, no way.
Right. Forensic interviewing. Look for, look for clues. So if I'm angry, it may only flash on my face and I'll give you something else, but you're going to get a step back. You're going to get an arm crossed. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a chin jut. You're going to get like 5 clues because I want you to know I'm unhappy.
Yeah.
I don't want to put it on my face because I'm a lady. Yeah. But I'm going to tell you in 22 different ways that I'm not appreciating what you're bringing to me right now.
But you can teach someone how to mute.
How to be more aware so they can better manage.
Okay.
That initial flash is really hard to like tamp down. Luckily, most people don't pay that much attention, especially now thanks to technology and how obsessed we are with their phones.
Yeah.
But also there's a lot more recorded stuff now. So you can actually catch things and replay it. And you know, there's a lot of like decoding you can do in interviews and things now that you didn't always have the leverage to do before.
Topic that I'm really interested to hear more about is being a human lie detector. I think a lot of people want to know how to do that. Be like, I know they weren't telling the truth. Because I do it with kids, you know, like, okay, let me see your hands. You know, like kids, you can just tell when they're lying, but you know, you fake it. what are some cues when someone is, I mean, I've heard that people lie, like, I think, honestly, I think it's like 7 times in every conversation. It's not like a huge lie, yeah, but they're like
an exaggeration.
Yes, like the fish was 5 feet when it was really, yeah, 2 feet. You know, like
we get
that
lied
kind
to,
of.
Like between blatant lies, white lies, misleading information, and withheld information up to 200 times a day.
Oh my gosh.
When you think about media, news, the programming that you're watching, wow, the people that you're interacting with, the things you're listening to, mm-hmm, if you add up all those errors, omissions, lies, you know, misstatements, withheld opportunities, it's like up to 200 times a day.
So before we even go into like what to look for, when you're saying you're a human lie detector, what kind of lies are you trying to catch?
It's blatant untruth.
Okay.
And knowing when something's withheld.
Okay.
So it can be something that's not stated that's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big part with forensic interviewing. When you're interviewing a subject, you can, there's a practice called statement analysis where you can actually go through and figure out based on level of detail, number of words that they use, words at the beginning versus the details versus the end. Like, yeah, you can pretty much, like, deception has a pattern.
Yeah.
And how people use the word instead of the to identify, because A is unknown, the is known, assuming you've already introduced it. Where you place yourself in a sentence next to other words and other people shows, yeah, distancing or shows omission. You know, how many words you use to describe an incident versus how many you use to tell me what you did prior to.
Wow.
So all of those things, there's a formula around, mm-hmm, that of showing deception. So a lot of it is really looking for what's not being said.
Yeah.
In addition to what actually is being misstated or is actually deceitful.
Do you have an example of when you were a human lie detector or something that you, like, caught on that was...
Well, I have a 13-year-old.
Oh.
Lots of examples.
So, like, I get to practice this all the time. And it's usually around, you know, social media, mm-hmm, activity, or things like that. So... But she just has pretty much given up at my house.
Yeah.
She's like, I can't be a teenager here. There's no point. You've ruined the experience. I'm like, well, go do that at your dad's. He doesn't know this stuff. But for me, I find myself very frequently, I'll tell you. So I was on a date with somebody a while back, and he was, again, confident, taking up space, very open. And we got on one topic, and he literally shrunk. Like... arms down, feet pulled up under the chair, like his, wow, physical domain was cut, mm-hmm, at least in half. And I try not to, especially like when I'm from an interpersonal standpoint, I try, mm-hmm, to go off duty where I just don't pay attention and I'm not analyzing.
Yeah.
I'm just like experiencing things in real time and enjoying the experience. But it was so blatant of a variance from what was normal or his baseline,
yeah,
around one specific topic that verbally was like, oh yeah, this is cool, everything's good, and then yet everything physically was like not at all the case. It was so crazy. Like, I remember it. I still can like feel what,
yeah,
I felt, because then I tried to not react,
yeah,
to act like I was buying into what he was saying, but I totally was so distracted by the fact that,
yeah,
it was like blatantly not true.
I don't know how you turn that off.
If it's really blatant and obvious, like, it's,
yeah,
hard. And I find myself doing it a lot with statement analysis. Like, as people are talking, I'm just like diagramming their words in my brain, and I'm like, no, that's not true.
So you're diagramming us right now?
No, I'm off duty.
Okay, good.
Other than focused on, you know, relaying information. This is not diagnostic.
So making yourself smaller is definitely something that, like, this might not be true, or like,
right,
I'm just uncomfortable with the
situation. Your body hates when you lie. Hates it, because our body knows that there's negative consequences for untruth. So there are 17 statistical physical cues of deception.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like getting small, your blink rate increases, your nose, your blood vessels in your nose swell a little bit and can sometimes itch. So there's like all these ways, like physiologically,
yeah,
and physically, that your body actually is like liar, 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 liar.
Huh.
So it tries to tell on you. It tries to tell
like...
you. But context is key, too, because,
yeah,
it's spring in Indiana, so
true,
itchy noses are like,
mm-hmm,
could just be allergies, or you,
yeah,
could be a big fat liar. I don't know. I need to talk more. You know, it's like, it's one of those things you don't ever want to make. And the thing with human lie detection is it's not just like a one and done answer. There's no silver bullet or you know, smoking gun here. It is a, to do it well, it's a 7-step scientific process of checks and rechecks and baselines and emotional baselines and variants. And it's a lot of work. And it's not in, it's part science and part art, but it is, it's not ever something that you want to be assumptive on. And you always want to go into it with the mindset that the person is being truthful. Assuming that people are being truthful actually gets you to deception quicker than assuming someone's lying.
I love that. We'll go back to my husband for a little bit. He calls himself a realist, which is just a good excuse of like...
to be negative. Yeah. Pessimistic. Yeah. I used to be a realist and I'm like, that's not a happy space to live.
Thank you. Yeah. Ben, come on.
Let's talk. I can give some
I like that you say like, just assume that the good in people before you assume the bad and actually can, then it's... I mean, I don't want to say then you can see the lies because then I feel like I'm doing what I say I'm not going to be doing. But... assume the truth and then...
Right, because the way that works is when you're assuming that someone is being honest with you, you're so much more in tune when there's a variance to tell you otherwise. Whereas if you start suspicious, everything is a clue. Yeah. Everything is a problem. And so if you start honest, like, well, why wouldn't they tell me the truth? Then when somebody pings something different, your radar is so much more alert than if you're disqualifying things you assume are dishonest. So it really makes you a better, because by default, like just not knowing any of the scientific process, we're about 54% accurate of determining truth or lies. So it's a coin, like legit a coin flip. Yeah. It's not super useful. We're wrong as much as we're right. But with a scientific process, you can get up to like 93% accurate or higher, depending on how much you practice it.
Wow. Did you watch Making a Murderer? I just have to know, like, did you watch it and watch Brennan Dassey in this
interview? I didn't, but my good friend Dave Thompson with Wicklander Zulowski in Chicago, which is who I've done keynotes for their team, and I'm certified as a forensic interviewer through their group. He actually was one of the scientific consults on his on his retrial and is working very, very hard to get justice served in that case and many other cases. So they do a lot with the Innocence Project.
Yeah.
Last year at Elite Training Day, there was one of our experts that came in was at false confessions. It was all around the psychology of false confessions.
Yeah.
And there are right now, probably more, but at that time, there were 19,000 people in the United States justice system incarcerated that had been completely exonerated DNA evidence.
Wow.
So there is no physical way
that
person committed that crime. But there is no urgency for retrials or for justice. So these people who have now, with new technology, been cleared.
Yeah.
Clearly wrongly convicted, sitting incarcerated in the U.S. right now.
Wow.
And the process to get their cases retried is so slow.
Is it because, like, Brennan, because they said they did it when they didn't? Is that... I'm getting off on a tangent. I realize that. But so is that the reason?
So when you're looking at, you know, false confessions, first of all, there's so much wrong with that investigation. Oh, like that's a 3-part series on its own. You should talk to my friend Dave. He can tell you all the details of that.
Future episode. Yeah. Look out for it, Dave.
Yeah. And so lots and lots wrong with that. But part of forensic interviewing is making sure that you are avoiding false confession. There's a series on Netflix right now, I think it's still on, called Confession Tapes, where it's like
I've heard of that one.
False confessions. And it's all these people that are just normal everyday people that the next thing you know they're confessing to something that they had nothing to do with and they're but the psychology is and especially if you're dealing with you know, sensitive or compromised populations, so people that are under the influence of something, people that have you know, neurodiverse situations, people that have some sort of mental health condition, which is really, really prevalent in the justice system right now, and how the conditions of the interview are so important. Length of interview, environment of interview, are there the right resources for that person? Because it's freaky, scary, easy how quickly you can get someone to confess.
Yeah.
And the key fault... Like, most people are like, especially if the interviewer or the investigator is saying, oh, well, we have, you know, is there any reason you can think of that we would have found your DNA at the scene? Mm-hmm. If they weren't there, they're like, no, absolutely. Go ahead. Yep. Sure. I'll sign whatever you need me to sign to get me out of this.
Yeah.
And you go run your DNA and you can apologize to me later.
Yeah.
But once the confession signed, jury believes that the person did it and the DNA may not really even exist. It may have been a false tactic.
Which brings...
So we trust truth and we trust justice. Yes. And then it bites us.
Yeah. That's like you were saying, I think, in the interview episode was that use it for good and not evil. And it can be easily turned, all of these tactics to try to get truth and try to understand what other people are feeling. Just so you can, like, adjust what you're doing. Right. But really, it can be used for evil.
Right. And that's what I love so much about Wicklander Zulawski. There was a methodology of interrogation called the Reed Method that was standard in law enforcement for years and years. And it was very confrontational. It was all about getting a confession. It wasn't about getting the truth. And so that was really a prevalent driver, in my opinion, to what led to so many falsely convicted people. So the Wicklander method is non-confrontational. And it's focused on getting the truth, not getting a confession.
Yeah.
And kind of reprogramming law enforcement's point of view as to what is success in an interview. It's not just a confession in a closed case. It's actually getting to the truth and following, you know, following the evidence versus statements. So that's why I continue to work and support them, is because they are really changing the way that law enforcement conducts interviews and hopefully eliminating a lot of false confessions and people sitting in jail that have been exonerated.
Well, tangent over.
Yeah, I could. I love it. That's a rabbit hole. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
We could do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah. The next topic I wanted to kind of cover is something I think I dealt more in high school and maybe even college, but is just feeling less awkward, being that awkward person. I still think I can hold some of those memories from high school, and I mean even like junior, who wasn't awkward in middle school?
I'm concerned about this generation because I feel like they don't have that awkward phase.
That is a topic in it, or an episode in of itself.
They're not allowed to have an awkward phase because everything's so well documented.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. Again, mother of a 13-year-old, I could go. We could go on that for a long time because it is terrifying.
So how can I pretend to not be awkward or tell myself I'm not awkward in my body language or facial expressions? Yeah. Because I feel like if other people don't think I'm awkward, maybe I'll stop feeling
awkward. I think the greatest gift that you can have is just remembering that you're human and reminding the person across from you that you are too. Because I promise you, if you feel awkward, the person across from you has, if they don't now, has felt awkward at some point. And when you can ping on that commonality and just put language behind it, they appreciate you so much more. So for me, you know, there's lots of times where I walk in and, you know, being a female in the space that I'm in and walking into predominantly male-dominated rooms, you know, there's times where the speaker rule is like, just call out the thing most people are distracted by so they can just get over it and come with you.
Yeah.
So they know that you know, and then you can. So when I'm standing in front of a room of, like, you know, storied and historical law enforcement figures who've been doing interrogations for 40 years and who am I? Right? I just say, I'm probably not what you expected to see on stage today. I just ask that you come along with me and see what you get out of it.
Yeah.
Disarmed. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, she knows that we don't think she should be here. And then they're done. And then they come along. So it's like, it's the same thing in interpersonal communication. It's like, man, you know, I always feel so awkward when I meet somebody for coffee for the first time. Me too. Right? Like, how many times can you be like, thank you for being human? And not being, and I get that. I psych myself out. I definitely fangirl on a lot of people. And there's people here that I've, you know, have admired from afar that I get introduced to or meet up with. And I'm just like, I'm not worthy, you know, like, and I will just say, you know, I was really nervous about meeting you today. And they're like, why? And then they turn out to be like the nicest, most amazing genius. Well, I was, you know, I always see you do this and I'm, you know, I haven't done that. And so I felt like, why would she want to meet with me? And so it like becomes this big like appreciation thing of just humanness. So I think just owning it and putting language behind it and giving someone the opportunity to join you in the awkward.
Yeah.
I also liked something that you said in the last episode we did with you about coming up with three intentions that you want to be or present yourself as when you meet with someone. So if you want to be likable as that one of your intentions or something, or you want to be less awkward, like maybe even just saying that out loud will help you.
Right. Like, I want to show up. I'm intimidated by this person, but I want to just show up as confident. I want to be really engaged. And I want to learn one thing about how she's been successful. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. my brain says you've got a game plan. You're good. So my confidence goes up because there's a strategy behind it. And then I know at least if I check those boxes, then that interaction is a success for me.
Yeah.
And that's a win. And so I always will set objectives that I know are wins for me. Because even if it goes sideways or it gets, you know, I've had meetings go sideways or people just not be nice or not be at all who you think they are. Mm-hmm. But it's never like, you know, bad dates. I don't have bad dates because my objective is before I have very clear intentions and I always hit those intentions and it's just one more human that I know isn't right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And off I go. Right. So it's not bad. I still learned I met my objectives.
Yeah. So it's not expectations. It's just the intentions.
No, intentions are what I want to actively work to receive mm-hmm. or what I want to actively work to create.
Yeah.
Expectations is like, I want you to bring me something.
Yes.
Or I expect you. It's your job now in this interaction that you don't know about, but you have a job and it's to meet one of my needs.
Yeah.
No, thank you. How often is that going to work out well? You know, so I try not to have expectations. I may have assumptions.
Yeah.
Or like theories about this if X happens, Y will probably mm-hmm. be the outcome. But it's not, I don't base my failure or success in an interaction on what someone else brings mm-hmm. to it. I try to create environments where I can get what I'd like to get out of it. Yeah. And that's not manipulation or you know, using someone. It's like, I really would love to hear about, I hope I create an opportunity where she feels comfortable telling me mm-hmm. one thing that she's found success with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's probably my biggest takeaway now for this episode is intentions versus expectations.
Yeah.
Because
expectations are a losing proposition every single time.
Yeah, and I think you can say, I'm just lowering my expectations. And that's not what you should
do.
Just come up with an intention. And
raise your intention.
You're giving something to them. Don't expect anything back from them. They are not trying there to fill your cup. And
right.
Gosh. What was your favorite thing about body language? We've covered a lot. It could be making a murder. That is fine if you have opinions about
Print and Death. I started How to Making a Murder and didn't finish it, and now I like really want to go back and watch
the second season already.
This has kind of convinced me with that, so I don't know if that's a good takeaway, but I'm going to start that probably this weekend. But for real, I think the whole intentions thing is a great takeaway for me also because it's something that I haven't done, and I think that's mm-hmm. something easy to implement that I can start doing with networking and all of that and going into any situation.
Yeah, it gives you a target, so so your energy is focused on something, and you don't feel like you just get what you get, or like you don't have a game plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm a control freak, so anything I can do to like follow a path that I have domain over, even if it's imaginary and not real, I still feel better.
Yeah. So do you have one? We've covered so many topics. As I said, do you have one last piece of advice about body language, either what you can do or what you can look at in others? That's just a really good like takeaway for our listeners.
Yeah. Well, first of all, don't ever sign a confession thinking that science will help you.
There we go.
Or justice will work for you.
For real.
Don't ever sign a confession if you didn't do anything. That would be my biggest like life lesson ever. Just don't ever sign a confession unless you did it. If you did it, take responsibility. If you didn't, don't sign the confession. But as far as body language goes, I think just really kind of presenting yourself in a way you would hope to have reflected back to you.
Yeah.
Right. So give people something positive that they can just mirror back to you
mm-hmm.
because you have more control over the temperature and tone of an interaction than you think you do.
Yeah. Isn't that typical that people will mirror what other people are doing in general, even if they don't know?
Mirror neurons. Yeah.
Yeah.
We reflect back primarily for understanding to make sure I'm experiencing things that I'm seeing accurately.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good clarifier. And then also to create connection, because that's ultimately what we're wired to do is to connect and connect deeply and helping people. We like people that remind us of ourselves.
Yeah.
And so when you mirror the things back to people that they're giving to you, then they feel like you're more familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, thank you for joining us again. I know you have some courses out there that people can do. Can you remind us of what those are?
Yeah, absolutely. Powerbodylanguage.com is where you can find me, and then you can just add /courses to the end of that or /events to the end of that, and that will show you where I'm at and what I'm training. A couple of courses on people reading playbooks, so you can get more of what we've talked about here as far as actionable tips that you can use every single day. And a virtual masterclass will be happening again in the fall. So that's where we jump on together live once a week and learn with a group of professionals of how we can all level up our communications game.
Great. Well, thanks again for joining us. And we'll have all of this on our show notes. And you can follow Lisa Mitchell at, what is your?
At Lisa Mitchell Indy. That's the best place to follow me on Instagram. That's where all the fun happens.
And if you live in,
on the show notes page as well.
And if you live in Indy, check out Indy Style on Wish TV.
Yep.
To see her there every once in a while, which I like to do. Anyways, thanks again, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.